Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
The 2019 FabFitFun Winter Box is on sale now. My wife Lisa was so excited to get her very first FabFitFun box, and this 2019 Winter Box is no exception. She's always excited to get her latest FabFitFun box. FabFitFun is a woman's lifestyle subscription box with all full-size, premium beauty, lifestyle, fitness, home and wellness products delivered to your door every season. No more hassle shopping. Every box is customized to your specific interests. The Winter Box makes a fantastic gift for someone special or even yourself this Christmas season. These boxes sell out quickly, so sign up for yours today. Some of the items are customizable, so my wife Lisa ordered the Bluetooth shower speaker by Bandu, very cool, and her favorites were goat milk moisturizing cream by Kate Somerville and especially the original makeup eraser. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value of over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Good evening. Experience some of the most intense hostage, serial homicide, mass casualty, stalking, and violent True Believer cases encountered by an expert during his 30-year police and forensic psychology career. Some of the scariest and most interesting criminals are broken down and analyzed by Dr. Chris Mohandy, an expert police and forensic psychologist who has met and evaluated some of the most dangerous people who have walked among us. This book has numerous first-hand accounts of his work and interviews for cases like the Angel of Death serial killer, racist serial assassin Joseph Paul Franklin, and even the O.J. Simpson case. Detailed case information, including excerpts of interviews he's conducted with these offenders, provides a platform to learn shocking new information about hostage takers, serial killers, mass murderers, violent true believers, terrorists, and some of the worst predators on the planet. The book that we're featuring this evening is Evil Thoughts, Wicked Deeds, with my special guest, forensic psychologist and author, Dr. Chris Mohandy. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Dr. Chris Mohandy.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you very much for joining us today. Fantastic.
Grateful to share this
as you
with you,
do.
Dan.
Thank you. Let's get right into this. This is just such a fascinating work, and you've evaluated and spoken with so many incredible criminals, killers, and you have such a fascinating work here for us to listen to about Evil Thoughts and Wicked Deeds. Take us back to 1988 when you were 24 years old, your second year in internship. You were moonlighting after hours at a private practice, and you tell us about meeting Dr. Martin Reiser or becoming involved in his orbit. Tell us how that happened, how you became interested. Tell us a little bit about that as you do in the book.
Well, 1988, I didn't know where I was going with my career per se. I mean, I thought I was going to hang a shingle out and maybe see clients on an ongoing basis and treat the worried well. And in walks into this private practice where I was moonlighting a guy who was contemplating a workplace mass casualty event. And back then, we didn't really know all that much about these things. They were just starting to happen. The words going postal was just, you know, were just being coined. And,
right.
You know, here I am. I don't have my PhD. I don't have my, you know, malpractice insurance and didn't really know quite what I was doing. And this gentleman walks in and, you know, wants to tell his story and maybe get some help. And he had felt mistreated at his workplace. He had blown the whistle on on some cost overrun issues in this defense contracting firm, and based upon the aftermath of that, felt he'd been retaliated against, and his response was to file a workers' comp case. And in that adversarial process, felt that his reputation had been maligned and that he'd been destroyed, and his solution was to create a list of people he wanted to kill, purchase an Uzi on the black market for $1,800, and basically come to the opinion that if the final hearing didn't go his way, he was going to kill all the people on his list. And here I am, a wide-eyed 24-year-old kid, saying, what do I do? Feeling overwhelmed, and that was 1988, and that was my first taste of this stuff, and thankfully that all kind of worked out, but it was scary.
Now, how did you come to learn of this director of behavioral science services section, Dr. Martin Reiser, and then how did you become involved with him? You say the real journey was about to begin.
There is the founder of police psychology, first in-house police psychologist in any department in the world. I think it was 1968 that was established at the LAPD. And, in 1988, I was in graduate school still, and there was a small little advertisement on the bulletin board at my grad school that said half-time unpaid internships at the LAPD with Dr. Martin Reiser. And, I'd already done one year of an internship at the Anaheim Police Department doing juvenile diversion counseling a couple years prior, and I thought, that I've got a little bit of experience here, and I spent more time talking to the officers, it seems. This seems like it's right on point, and not realizing the legend that I was reaching out to, I said, I'm going to look into this. It might be a nice niche. So I contacted Dr. Reiser, and I think it was January of 1989, went and interviewed with him, and he said, as soon as you graduate in May, I'll take you on as an intern. And in that time period, somebody said, hey, you know who that is? That's the guy that founded police psychology. He developed investigative hypnosis. He developed the protocols for how you deal with officers after shootings. He's the guy that was the kind of the first police psychologist to be attached to negotiation teams. LAPD may have been the third to get hostage negotiation in the 70s. But part of their ground floor development of their hostage teams was to have a psychologist attached to the team and roll out on all these events. And that's in no small measure because of Dr. Reiser's groundbreaking work in establishing his credibility. So I got lucky, saw an ad, and went in and I was well received. And that was the beginning of my that was the real beginning of my education.
Certainly. Now, you talk about write about in this book the practical world that you were in, the psychology, operational psychology that you were involved with, and you talk about a Vietnamese man that was high on crack. Again, you talked about earlier about a successful, basically, intervention when you ran to the supervisor and said, listen, what should we do? And he ran back and you negotiated with him. You said, wrote in the book that you would have done things differently today. Now,
I want to jump in on what you just said. It was very astute of you to call what we did in that room with the guy that wanted to kill all his supervisors and people at his workplace a negotiation, because in retrospect, you're right. That's what that was. Before I'd even had any training in it, we were working this guy, basically helping him come to his conclusion that, hey, this is not the best solution. There are other solutions to this problem, and it doesn't involve hurting people. That your method of problem solving here, sir, is one method, and here's some others. But you're right, and then I end up finding my way to real negotiation training at the LAPD. I went into the first course that they had when I got on board. I got to sit in on that. It's a 40-hour course, and but yes, I did have a prelude of that in the practice in 1988.
Now, tell us about this Vietnamese man and this really vivid scene that you write about with this man, and you're trying your best to avert him being killed. So tell us about this and the negotiations therein.
So this was a gentleman, a Vietnamese male, who had been estranged from his family. The title of the chapter in the book is It's a Good Day to Die, because that morning he called his psychiatrist, who he had been seeing for a workers' comp claim he had. He had thought he'd been mistreated at his workplace, too. Interesting themes here. And yet that psychiatrist had come to the opinion that, you know what, it's your drug problem, not how people are treating you that's causing these issues in the workplace. And so he had called that psychiatrist in the morning, having reached the end of his rope, and said, you know what, Dr. Griffin, today is a good day to die. And that is what prompted the call to the location. And what had happened is that he had gone there to kill his family and then himself. And fortunately, his family had escaped, yet his three-year-old daughter, Janet, had not been so fortunate, and she ends up stuck with her dad, who is on a collision course with, you know, fatal destiny. And he's basically, you know, wanting to kill her and kill himself. So it's a murder-suicide in progress. He's armed with a handgun. He's been smoking crack, and he's coming down, and he's done. You know, he wants to end his life. Unfortunately, that's where he was at, and he wanted to take his daughter with him. It was horrible. And a little bit more to his story is that he had fallen out of favor with his family. There had been some shame issues related to a death side vigil with his brother-in-law. He had said some inappropriate things. The family had basically ostracized him, as they should have, given what he was saying and doing. He had driven several thousand miles to a famous treatment center, Hazleton, in Minnesota, spent a couple days there, and checked himself out AMA because, you know, it was too much like the prison camp he'd been in when he was in Vietnam. So being locked up, even for treatment, wasn't an option for him. So so he drives back, tells the family, hey, I couldn't do it. And they said, see, you didn't even finish that. He drives back again to try to get himself back in the facility. They say, nope, we're not taking you. And now he's at the end of his rope, and that's when he arrives back in Los Angeles, you know, basically hell-bent on destruction. And so we find out from the good doctor that had been treating him about this history. And, of course, that goes to the difficulty in negotiating with him, because if we're going to try to help him, he is not willing to check himself in anywhere, let alone go to jail. So in his own mind, he had created no way out other than death and destruction. So it was one of the worst hostage incidents I'd ever been at. You've got an innocent life in the balance, a guy that, you know, wants to end his own, but not before taking his own flesh and blood, and it's just a matter of time. And here I am, you know, is 1992 or whatever. I'm, you know, 29 years old, and, you know, I'm giving input to this team. And part of my job as a consultant to the hostage negotiation teams of the SWAT team at LAPD is this negotiable? You know, is there any hope here? And can we work this guy? And I had to basically weigh in after having tried all kinds of talking strategies with our really excellent negotiators who were Vietnamese language speakers. They hadn't been through the training yet, but they did everything they were supposed to. And it was just not going to end with a verbal resolution. And so I was thrust into life and death, kind of decision making. Which is not what graduate school prepares you for, Dan.
Yeah. This was a heartbreaking story, and this is early in the book as well, because it really shows the police and yourself and the negotiating team did everything they could to prevent this. It really, really was. I mean, it's not to be understated, is that he had every opportunity, especially with these Vietnamese officers that did a stellar job of connecting. You told them to call him, you know, a brother. And so it looked like there was some hope here. It looked like there was a lot of hope, actually, based on the techniques that you guys employed. But in the end, heartbreaking. No,
three-year-old
with no father.
Himself into a corner, and just he was having none of it. And then you have the chemical influence, Dan, of being high on crack cocaine, which, you know, stimulants are very much associated with high risk and for violence potential. But then when you're crashing, you know, the despair that one may already feel, is amplified by, you know, the neurochemical imbalance that has been created by the up, you know, because what goes up must come down, and that's what was happening. So that's what we were up against, and, you know, it was, you know, kind of my first foray into just how bad things can get and how quickly they could go bad, and then just how important it is what law enforcement does and the efforts in negotiation to buy time, even if you can't negotiate, you know, solutions will present themselves the more time you can buy. And we're able to do that and, you know, wear him down. And ultimately, you know, it's not going to be a great outcome for him. I don't want to spoil anything unless you want to ask about it, but it was intense.
Absolutely. You learn from all of these situations, ones that turn deadly and ones that don't, and the ones that you've prevented things from happening. You talk about a serial killer unlikely in terms of where you might find this person, and that's at a hospital.
Right.
Let's talk about Efren Saldivar.
Oh, Efren Saldivar, the so-called angel of death that was preying on patients at the Glendale Adventist Hospital here in Glendale for many years. You know, he's kind of a low-key, affable, you know, seemingly affable guy. He would not send off your spidey senses as a guy that is a threat or a menace. You know, at one point he had been a checker at the local supermarket, and you know, he saw a guy come through the line with a stethoscope on and scrubs, and he says, "How do I get one of those?" And the guy says, "Well, I'm a respiratory therapist." And he goes, "Well, how much education does that take?" And the guy says, "Well, here's what it takes." He goes, "Geez, I could do that. You know, I could have the seeming power of the outfit and, you know, the things that I get to do, but without having to, you know, go to medical school." So he was attracted to the power of the job, but not the kind of guy that would seem like a wolf. He was a wolf in sheep's clothing, and unbeknownst to those around him, his yearning and his hunger for power over life and death, and the playing God aspect of that had been sown years before through his upbringing and through his reading of a book called Upon a Pale Horse. It's kind of a comic book style, you know, kind of in the dark sense, where a guy ends up startling the Grim Reaper or death as he's sending souls either to heaven or hell. Death ends up dying, and the guy in the book has to assume death's role. I think Saldivar was in his teens when he read this book, and he had an epiphany, an identification with that character that kind of lay dormant. Years later, when I would interview him after he was ultimately convicted of some of the homicides that he perpetrated in the hospitals, he remembered that experience of having read the book and the impact it had upon him. Then he tried to downplay it, but it was clear that it had filled a void for him, an inner sense of purpose and meaning, and that for a guy like him who had never felt powerful or any sense of potency, kind of an inadequate guy, it elevated him. And the secrecy aspect of what he was doing as he stealth, you know, approached people in the hospital that supposedly met his code, it fulfilled him, and it lifted him out of depression, it lifted him out of despair, and it served a purpose for him.
You write that he told you in an interview that his Kevorkian, Kevorkian was a hero to him.
Yes,
and
he was.
And he actually gave you some enlightenment to his situation by saying what really triggered this sort of, obsession and interest, watching a man suffocate. Tell us what you gleaned from him, what he told you about this incident and how it influenced him. And then you can talk about the drug that you talk about, full cognitive awareness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So there was a life-changing experience he describes where he perceived that there was a person that was dying, that was supposedly dead or dying in the hospital, And, you know, life-ending measures had been terminated, and supposedly it was, you know, it was, this person was supposedly just going to succumb to, you know, his natural death. Didn't happen. And so his accounting of it is that a nurse or somebody there turned him, we got to do something. This isn't good. And at that point, you know, he said, well, I guess this is what I'm supposed to do. And then, you know, his version of the story is that he finished, you know, what was supposed to happen naturally. That is, ended this guy's life that was life-saving measures were supposed to end. He was supposed to die naturally. Now, I keep saying his version because there is a tendency among these types of individuals to attribute more approval from those around them than than – you know, is likely really being given. But in his own mind, he concluded, this is what I'm supposed to do. And that was like kind of the intersection between the fantasy of being in the role of death, the Grim Reaper, and the reality. And it's kind of like, you know, I often use the analogy of, you know, once the genie, analogy or metaphor, that once the genie is let out of the bottle, you can't put him back in again. And the genie being the, I've done it. And it's in the world of possibility and probability. And once you kind of done it, meaning taking human life in this fashion for these purposes, it becomes something that they just can't stop doing. Now, they may have cooling off periods, you know, that serve the purpose of not getting caught. But, you know, it's like once they've had a drink, they can't put the bottle down. And so his task was, you know, as he saw, was to find out, well, how do I do this? And what does he have access to as a respiratory therapist? He has access to these agents, succinylcholine and pavilion, which are curare-like substances that are designed to allow him to intubate patients. And thus it needs to induce paralysis so that they're not choking and gagging. But what it does is it stops the breathing, so the breathing tube can be put in, an artificial respiration can occur, and yet the person is completely conscious. So the person is aware that they can't breathe and they're suffocating until the tube goes in and it's done. But if a person is administering this as a method of homicide, it's a particularly traumatic, you know, all forms of death in some ways arguably are, some less than others, but in this case, you have full wakefulness and awareness in the victims, but with a complete inability to say or do anything about it. So it's like frozen terror that's completely perceived, experienced fully, but they're immobilized and they can't do anything to express it. So if you think about those dreams you may have had where, you know, you can't move and your body's stuck and these things are happening around you that we might experience in that transition from wakefulness to sleep, it's like that, but with absolute terror. And that was the kind of death that he was inducing in his patients. So it seems peaceful because they're not struggling, they're not moving because they can't, but it's absolute horror and terror.
Now, we talked about your evaluations. Tell us what these cases all about evaluation for
no,
court cases?
Go ahead.
No, that's what I wanted to ask.
In a way, I mean, when I'm out on a hostage incident, I'm doing an assessment. My job is to assess in the moment what's going on and what strategies might be, and recommend strategies, assess negotiability, things to do, things not to do, and strategies that might help diminish risk, you know, those kinds of things. So that's a form of psychological assessment, you know, for negotiation. In the situation I was retained in for the Saldivar case, the Angel of Death, I was brought in another operational role, and that was as a consultant to the task force, which I consulted with them for like 4 to 5 years because it took that long to put the case together. Once it was disclosed that there might have been victims and there might be a case, my role in that matter was to help understand how these kinds of offenders offend. We actually went and interviewed some other ones, reviewed other cases, interviewed other offenders that had killed in hospitals, one of whom was Donald Harvey in Ohio. to feed that information to the investigation, because the task in the investigation at that point was to, gosh, you know, thousands of people have died in this hospital, many of natural causes. How do we find the 20 bodies that we want to exhume and increase the likelihood that if they were victims of Saldivar, that they would be, you know, within his pool of victims, that is his victimology. And so my assessment there was, you know, what kind of offender are we dealing with here? You know, how do we approach him? You know, how do we think about who he was selecting? So that's a different form of evaluation or assessment in this operational sphere. And then there's times when I work on cases, I won't get too far, you know, into the specifics of certain ones, but I do a lot of insanity cases where I'm retained, you know, like somebody's killed one or more people or hurt people, and their defense is I was insane at the time, you know, and my job is to actually go in and interview, do traditional psychological testing maybe, and then assess whether they didn't know what they were doing and didn't know that it was wrong because of a mental disorder. And I've done, you know, I do a fair amount of that to present day, usually in homicide cases, and then sometimes I'll get brought in on death penalty cases to do assessments, both for defense and for prosecution, around issues of mitigation or aggravation. That you know, a lot of times the defense will raise an issue, tough childhood, or gosh, he's got mental problems, and then there's other hypotheses to explore. Maybe the person's just a stone cold psychopath, and so I get brought in on those cases. I've done, you know, some serial murder cases in that regard. I was on the Grim Sleeper case in L.A., for example. And then the Aurora Theater shooting case, I consulted to the prosecution in Colorado. So that's a different form of assessment. And then there's threat assessment work that I do, which might be a company hires me or a school. They've got somebody they're worried about that's a potential risk or danger, and then I might get brought in either to directly or indirectly assess whether there in fact are risks. So there's a lot of different forms of assessment and evaluation, Dan, and that's what makes my job never a dull moment.
Absolutely. Tell us about who coined the term violent true believer. Explain what you mean by violent true believer before we talk about Joseph Paul Franklin.
A violent true believer is a term to describe a philosophically motivated killer, a guy that, or woman, guy who is doing it for a purpose that might be, you know, to advance some sort of cause. Like it could be because they're Islamist, and I use the term Islamist. Not as Islam, but as a person that's advocating radical versions of Islam to go after people that are infidels, you know, like the 911 hijackers would be Islamists, as opposed to true Muslims or people practicing the usual peaceful forms of Islam. Then there are violent true believers that might be single issue offenders, people like that are against abortion, or animal rights people that advocate violence to fulfill their higher purpose or objectives. And then there's people that have a racist agenda, like you know, white supremacists. Those would be some examples of violent true believers. The term true believer comes from a book by Eric Hoffer called The True Believer, and in the aftermath of 9/11, Dr. Reed Malloy, who's a very well-regarded forensic psychologist, a good friend of mine, and I were saying, gosh, you know, we did an analysis of it, we published it, and in that process, we were going to use the term true believer, and Reed said, you know, Dr. Malloy said, you know, that it's really not just true believers. There's a lot of true believers out there. We're talking about violent true believers, people that are willing to use violence in favor of it, and thus the term was coined in our homicidal and suicidal states of mind article that came out in 2001, just after 9/11 happened. And it was Reed that suggested putting the violent in front of the true believer. So I give him credit for you know, the Violent True Believer label, and then the article was one that was co-authored by him, myself, and some other noted people in the area of mass homicide publications and scholarly research.
Right.
And it's one now that's in usage. It's used a lot. I remember watching a James Bond movie. I think it was the first one with Daniel Craig. And I remember M saying, "Well, he's not even a true believer." And it's like, wow, this term has now become dispersed and is in use by the people that we want to be using it, you know, in the intelligence and anti and counterterrorism communities, and now it's found its way into the art that imitates life.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, talk about Detective Trapp. Three women disappear in Santa Ana, California. A detective, Julissa Trapp, always dreamed of being a cop. Now she was an unconventional detective in an all-male homicide squad. Detective Trapp overcomes her own demons and an apathetic society to bring a serial killer to justice. In a new podcast from Wondery and the LA Times, Detective Trapp takes the listener into her personal life and her esteemed police work. It's hosted by award-winning journalist Chris Gofford. While listening, be sure to subscribe to Detective Trapp on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, check out the link in the episode description. Now, Chris, we were talking about Joseph Paul Franklin.
Yes.
Particularly interesting case. And tell us about your meeting with him and your interview in prison with him, what he had to say about the why.
Joseph Paul Franklin was probably one of the most interesting serial murderers that I've ever met, one of the scariest and one of the most disturbing because of what he represents and the fact that it's still this kind of person is still out there and these ideas are still being put out to inspire people like this. But Joseph Paul Franklin, I came across a couple years before I actually interviewed him myself. I had gone out on an interview for a show that I'd been involved with where they were interviewing him. The show never aired, or I think the pilot only aired or whatever. But based upon hearing what he had to say and learning more about him, I said, I got to get it back out there and talk to this guy. This is intense. And it was because he'd killed 23 people in racially motivated homicides. He was trying to start a racial holy war. He was hoping to, cause a war between African Americans and Caucasians and divide, you know, our society. And he actually was sort of inspired, well, not sort of inspired, he was inspired by some of the racists like the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the original ones, Nathaniel Bedford Forrest, who founded the KKK back then as a terrorist organization. Joseph Paul Franklin had actually been in some of the KKK groups in his part of the country, in the South, and found them too moderate for him, thought it was all just a bunch of, parades and, you know, that kind of thing. And he thought, you know, we need action. And so he decided to embark on what he called his mission. And his epiphany was a moment when he was, I think it was Christmas Eve, about a year before he did what he did. He was frustrated because he couldn't get a job as a, quote, white man. And then he fell back on all the rhetoric he'd been, immersing himself in. People like Herbert Armstrong at the Worldwide Church of God and other, the guy that wrote Turner Diaries, William Pierce, all these people were part of the voices that he listened to and was inspired by. And at that moment in Maryland, he said, I'm gonna do this. And he was frustrated, he couldn't get a job, and he attributed it to his racist beliefs that the society was not taking care of the white man anymore. And so for a year, he readied himself for his mission. He was born under a different name. I think his first name was Vaughn. And he ended up changing his name to Joseph Paul Franklin legally. Joseph Paul, as homage to the Nazi propaganda minister, Joseph Paul Goebbels, was one of his heroes. And then Franklin, in homage to Benjamin Franklin, who he considered one of the first true Americans. So his identity literally became synonymous with his mission. And he started, you know, targeting Jewish people, mixed race couples, and then he's actually the guy that shot Larry Flint in, right. I think it was 1977, because he had seen in Hustler publications, Larry Flint had the first mixed race sexually explicit pictorial. And when he saw it, when Joseph Paul Franklin saw it, he was enraged, said, I'm going to kill him. And so then he targeted him, Vernon Jordan, and then 23 other people that lost their lives, including one police officer, because of his desire to perpetuate or promote supremacy and to try to start a racial holy war. And just one last footnote on that. One of his other heroes was Charles Manson. Many people think of Charles Manson as the cult leader that he was. But if you look closer, Charles Manson was also racially motivated. The whole helter-skelter thing was about causing a war between whites and blacks in our society at the time. And so Joseph Paul Franklin was aligned with those ideas as well.
Now, you talk about the interview lasted several hours, but let's talk about some of the things you say about in terms of suicide and homicide being very, very similar, or just opposite sides of the coin. You can explain.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a guy named Schneidman who wrote a really exceptional book on the suicidal mind. And he identified 10 commonalities that we see in suicidal individuals, one of which is that it's an attempt at solving a problem. It's not a problem-solving method we recommend, but it is an attempt. It's a flawed problem-solving mechanism. It also stems from a perceptual distortion of restricted ability to see options. So we call that perceptual constriction. And an inability to see that, you know what, there are other options other than taking your life. And then there is an emotional state of hopelessness. And then we talk about the consistency of lifelong styles, that the way a person goes about their suicide typically reflects the way they live their life. So if they're more organized or impulsive, the act of suicide is going to reflect that. In looking at a lot of the homicides that I've seen, there is a very similar process among people where it is a dysfunctional way of trying to solve an interpersonal problem usually. There is constriction of the person's ability to see other options. And the way they go about it does typically reflect lifelong styles, and there usually is some hopelessness, you know, kind of wrapped into the equation. So there are a lot of commonalities, and in seeing a lot of like the mass casualty suspects, the people that like Joseph Paul Franklin that are willing to die, not necessarily intending to die, and then looking at violent true believers, notice that, you know, that there is a fair amount of overlap between these populations, so that, which is part of the reason why we see a lot of times the end of a mass casualty event is the person taking their life, because the same factors that got them to direct that outward are started with initially directed inward at self-destruction, because to hurt other people, in my opinion, is a form of self-destruction. It is against our species not only to hurt ourselves but to hurt others. And just as a footnote here, if anybody out there is feeling hopeless or helpless and like hurting themselves or others, there is hope. There are people that care, and this too shall pass. And all the people that I've ever talked to that have made the decision, like that guy at the beginning of my book, they've all been glad that they did not do it. So that's that's an important message to get out there. I have that message in my book, but I think this is a nice place to put it in. But there is overlap between harming others and harming oneself, both in the internal processes that get you there, and in terms of if one is thinking about hurting oneself. I'm not saying most people are suicidal or homicidal, but I will say that there is a greater risk of being able, if you've already got over thou shalt not kill thyself because of your distorted thinking, that I believe, lessens the inhibitions against harming other people. Again, I want to be clear, most people that want to hurt themselves do not want to hurt other people. But if you compare populations of those that are contemplating self-harm versus those that are not, you're going to find statistically, I believe, more people that have also gotten over the hurdle of hurting other people in the I got over hurting myself population.
You say
that makes sense.
You write, yes, it does, certainly. You write that you learned much more from one particular person named Jeffrey Cox. Tell us what you learned and why you learned more from this person that survived, which is rare.
Jeffrey Cox was one of the first school shooters, and when I say I learned more, I learned a lot more about school shootings from talking to him, and he never even, right. You know, it really wasn't completed, but all the variables were there. It was February of 1988, which was before all these other school shootings had really happened, the mass of them. And he was at a small school here in near my home in Pasadena, California, and in San Gabriel High School in Alhambra. And he had come to the conclusion that he needed to take his class hostage, maybe hurt some people, maybe demand some money and plane tickets to Brazil as his way of resolving the fact that he wasn't going to be graduating and he didn't want to be forgotten about. So what do you got all in this situation? You've got suicidality, you've got weapon seeking, you've got him talking to his friends about it beforehand, you've got him, you know, in the throes of adolescent decision making, which isn't always the best,
right.
And then you've got him wanting notoriety. And back then there was no social media, right? So it's like,
right.
You know, he just wanted to make the news in the newspaper and to be remembered. And we're seeing just so much of that now that if the first goal are all the issues that the person is struggling with and feeling ashamed or, you know, worthless, and that violence has become the solution to the problem, the second layer we're seeing on a lot of these school shooting cases these days, not all of them, but a lot of them, is the hunger to be remembered, you know, wanting, you know, your 15 minutes of fame or your followers to increase, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's available on a scale that we've never seen before. But Jeff was the leader of the pack in a lot of respects and just taught me a lot about the thought process, the way his decision-making was at the time, because he's had time to reflect upon it and was very thoughtful, very bright, and talked about how his decision-making was, things were black and white. You either do this, you do this. And his inability to kind of pull himself back once he had kind of told other people, what am I going to do, back out? That would just, you know, my ego couldn't take that. And so there were just so many pure lessons in the interview he so graciously gave to me those years ago. That I would, when I would do school violence and prevention or threat management workshops, which I still do to this day, I would invariably show like about 5 to 7 minutes of clips of Jeff talking about how he came to that decision, what he was thinking, and kind of giving a living demonstration of how he got there and where the mistakes were in terms of managing it. And the lessons haven't really changed. Lessons were all encapsulated there.
Mm-hmm. The story, the official story about Columbine, and you talk about the Columbine effect in this.
Right.
We can discuss that. But there are some things that happened in Columbine, that official narrative that you dispense with here, you dispel, I should say. Tell us a little bit about the Columbine effect and what you found out about Columbine shooting itself.
Well, the Columbine effect is the label that's been given over the last several years to the fact that many school shooters and even other mass casualty shooters have studied Columbine and refer to it as they contemplate their own event. The Columbine effect refers to the psychological phenomena of identification. And there's
right.
a lot of people that have had impulses to hurt others that have been, disturbingly inspired by Columbine and used that as their template, if you will, to plan and unfortunately perpetrate some of these acts that have happened around the world. And so that's the label for that phenomenon. And many of these people aren't even in America. There was a couple from Finland and Germany that were inspired to do it, Brazil, Australia, of course, Canada. And some of these people that have been inspired by Columbine weren't even born or conscious of these kinds of things because they were either not born yet or children. So what happened is that it became what we refer to in the profession as a watershed event, one that becomes a reference point culturally, part of the cultural script, and that those that have interest in this area, even if they weren't born yet, study it. And there's all kinds of stuff, unfortunately, in social media. So the Columbine effect refers to the fact that there's been at least at this point 100 known plots, some of which were interrupted and some which were carried out, that have resulted in the deaths of dozens of people that were unfortunately by individuals that identified with specifically the offenders at Columbine. The myths of Columbine, there were these ideas that these two boys were horrendously bullied and that they, had these tumultuous pasts. And they really didn't. They really weren't bullied any more than anybody else. Bullying is a high-frequency event on high school and middle school campuses, unfortunately. But it's so high-frequency that if bullying were the cause of school shootings, we would be seeing like so many more than we actually do. It's estimated that 40% of kids have some involvement in bullying at some point in their lives, either as a bully, as a victim, or both. And there was this claim or this, that the offenders from Columbine, were bullied. They were dishing it out just as much as they were receiving it. There was this myth that they were isolated. They weren't. I think one of them had actually gone with a bunch of his friends in a limo, all fancily dressed, to prom the weekend or a weekend or two before the shooting. So there's more going on here than the simple explanation of these poor suffering kids. They were not poor suffering kids. They were spoiled, overindulged kids with families that didn't know really quite what they had and then kind of enabled them instead of holding them accountable for when they were pushing limits and breaking rules and, didn't quite know what they were dealing with. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't kids like I talk about Evan Ramsey from Alaska who have horrendous background.
Right.
But, these two kids, they were the spoiled, narcissistic variety.
You discuss sanity. I don't want to discuss it too much, but there's a difference between a sanity hearing and then the idea that someone can be deemed insane. You, unlike many psychologists, I think, at least might have a little different opinion about sanity in the courtroom. Tell us about some of the things you write about.
Well, sanity, we all say, oh, he must be insane. That's an everyday, there's the everyday statement by people, gosh, that guy did that horrible thing. He must be insane. Okay, that's the everyday use of the word insane. In courts, it is a very specific legal definition that has to be proved by the defense once there's been a criminal trial of guilt. So there's two phases in most criminal trials, the guilt phase, and then if the person puts their mental state at issue, there's the sanity phase. And the presumption in most states is that the person is in the presumption in most states is that the person is sane, and it's the job of defense, if the evidence is there, to prove that the person is insane at usually a lower threshold preponderance of the evidence as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, there are several prongs that often come up. The first is, do they really have a mental disorder? We're not talking that they're under the influence or they're just difficult people that have trouble getting along with others. But a bona fide mental disorder like bipolar or schizophrenia, where they're hearing things or seeing things or just not perceiving the world in a realistic way. That's the first thing. Do you have a mental disorder? And then it's the job to find out whether they didn't know what they were doing was wrong or that somebody was being hurt. Maybe they thought by – I had one guy that – he stomped on a guy to death. I had one offender that stomped a person to death because he believed that that's in his deluded thinking that that was breaking bread with Christ, and that that was the person wasn't dying. It was simply a heavenly act of some sort. Okay, so sure. He didn't even get that somebody had died when he stomped the person to death. Okay, so that's one way a person could be found insane, is because their mental state prevents them from understanding that somebody's being hurt. Another is, hey, it wasn't wrong. I had another guy that shot two people to death that believed that that there was a government conspiracy and the government had replaced all these people with fake people, and that there was this whole lawlessness that was going on, and that it wasn't against the law, and that it was he was defending himself against this government conspiracy. And again, that goes to the wrongfulness prong. So insanity is a very specific legal definition that does not apply to the vast majority of criminals that claim it. There's a small percentage that actually are found insane by juries, but most people are found sane because there's very specific criteria for it.
When they are deemed insane, does that prompt a trial if they were to be deemed sane by doctors?
I'm not understanding the question. I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
When they're deemed insane by the courts in these rare cases, will those people then be tried for their crime once they're deemed, if they're deemed sane by those same doctors?
The typical way it's dealt with is the guilt phase is first. So there's a guilt phase. The person may be found guilty of first or second degree murder or whatever the crime might be. And then the person says, well, we're claiming not guilty by reason of insanity. Then there's usually, in California, for example, a second trial on the sanity. And if they're found insane at that point by that court proceeding, the jury says, no, we think he's insane. Then they're going to go to a psychiatric hospital until the hospital deems them sane and no longer a danger to the community. And there's assessments that take place. Some people are never found to be restored to sanity or deemed not a danger to the community if they're released. And then some are. They're released all the time with varying levels of controls. So there can be cases where they might hold other charges as hey, if he gets out, these charges are waiting. But in most cases, it's kind of an all or nothing thing, and they're convicted, and then they're sent to a hospital, and then once the hospital deems them capable of being released, boom, they're back out in the community again, at least in California, for example.
Absolutely. Let's get to your work with stalking, and of course, one of the most famous stalkers of all time, if people don't know, is O.J. Simpson. So tell us a little bit about your work with stalking and your personal experience in the O.J. case.
So I've been doing stalking cases since Probably my first year at LAPD, we started seeing stalking cases. Now, mind you, in 89, stalking wasn't even a crime at that point. I think the first stalking statutes on the book were in California in like 90-ish. That came about from the tragic murder of Rebecca Schaefer. And then LAPD formed the first threat management unit to work stalking cases. And at that point, I started consulting with the threat management unit on their cases occasionally. And then we embarked on a massive research project where we looked at 1,005 stalkers. It's published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences. I think it was 2006. It's the biggest single study of stalkers. And we developed a way of categorizing them into four primary categories. One is the intimate stalker. That's somebody that's pursuing a victim that they've had a relationship with, either married to, ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, and then no longer they have a relationship, and they're pursuing them. The second type is the acquaintance stalker. It might be, you know, somebody that you were a coworker with, or it might be a victim who is a healthcare provider and it's their patient pursuing them, or a boss being pursued by an ex-employee. That would be an acquaintance stalker. Then there's the public figure stalker, which is, you know, when Hoskins was pursuing Madonna. He never knew Madonna. He just saw her in the media and said, hey, that's my wife. And he had all kinds of delusions. And many public figure stalkers are delusional, have serious mental problems. And then there's what I call the private stranger stalker, somebody that's just in your environment. They might live in your neighborhood or work. You're working at the mall, and just some guy that's unstable forms a fixation upon you, but you've never met them. They might be somebody in the universe at your college who just becomes fixated upon you. And what we found was the highest violence rates were in the intimate stalking group. We had like, I think, a 74% violence rate. And then the second highest was the acquaintance stalkers at 50%. And then the private stranger stalker violence rate was 36%, and then the public figure stalker rate was at 2%. Now, does that mean that if you're a public figure and you got somebody like Hoskins coming after you, that you should be not concerned? No, I think some of the low rate of that is because a lot of public figures have entourages, and it may also have been an artifact of the data set that we were using. The issue is, what is the person doing? You know, and are they engaging in risky behavior? That's what we look at. But it was a great study that we managed to get published. It was myself, Reed Malloy, Peter Collins, I think was in it, and a couple other people. And it was just super interesting. But throughout the years, I've worked a ton of stalking cases. I've evaluated them, interviewed them in prison. I interviewed Hoskins. And, of course, you mentioned O.J. Simpson, and that absolutely was an intimate stalking case where he was not letting go of Nicole Brown Simpson. And, unfortunately, what ends up happening is he ends up killing her and Ron Goldman, who just happened to be, I believe, in the wrong place at the wrong time. My involvement in the O.J. Simpson case was on that fateful my involvement in the O.J. Simpson case was on that fateful Friday. I was on call for the hostage negotiation team at LAPD, and like many, during that day, we were all watching the news because he was supposed to turn himself in at noon. Did not. And right. Then what happens in our office at the Behavioral Sciences of LAPD is we start joking. I wonder what time he's going to be a call out. You know, that's what we called it when we go out after hours, or we'd have a barricade or a hostage incident. And I head home to Pasadena. I'm on call. And next thing I know, I'm listening to the radio. I'm, you know, listening to some rock and roll or whatever, and they kept interrupting with a pursuit. Now, at that time frame in American history, pursuits were breaking in on TV all the time. And this was the first time one had interrupted a radio program. I'm like, what is this? And then I realized it was the slow-speed pursuit that it was underway, and that caused me to call the hostage team, SWAT headquarters, and they said, yep, we're going to head to the residence. He's supposed to go there to surrender, and we need you to go there. And so I did. I raced over to the other side of town, which was a trip in and of itself, made it over there very fast, but not without seeing the craziness under the on the overpasses, the crowds of people that were at the base of Rockingham when I pulled up my city car there. If I hadn't come behind the captain that oversaw SWAT, I'd still be sitting out there. There were so many people at the base of that street, Dan. It was like 500 people at the base of the street chanting. It was a circus like none other. I get through that crowd, pushing and shoving against the car, and park in front of the house and meet Mike Albanese, who you've seen mentioned throughout my book. He was the sergeant at the time overseeing the negotiations. Said Robert Kardashian was there. We got a briefing from Robert Kardashian about what was going on with Simpson. Simpson at the time had just pulled into the driveway, was barricaded in the car with AC in the front, and he had a gun to his chin. They put a bulletproof vest on me, sent me through the backyard and into the house. I'm doing my assessment as I'm going through the backyard. What kind of guy is this? You know, I didn't watch much football. All I knew about Simpson was he'd gone to school with my dad when my dad was at USC. But going through the backyard, it became very clear what kind of person he was. He had two full-size statues of himself in the backyard, and his whole interior walls were covered with pictures of himself. No family photos, like you saw during the trial, just pictures of himself. We jokingly called it the house was done in early OJ. I get in there. I get to the doorway. I'm behind Pete Wireeater, who was the negotiator. Pete Wireeater, handsome SWAT guy, who also was one of our best negotiators. And if you ever see any movies like Clear and Present Danger, Pete was good friends with Harrison Ford, would often appear in Harrison Ford movies playing different roles, which is where, again, art imitates life, life imitates art. But in this situation, it was life. And Pete was negotiating with him, and O.J. was not sure if he wanted to kill himself or whatever. And so the task at hand is to reinflate a narcissist who's deflated by the humiliation of all this. And we used what was there. Look at all these people. You saw him. You still have a ton of people believe in you. He wasn't worried about his deceased ex-wife or this man who lost life, Ron Goldman. All he was worried about was himself and his image. And that's what we did. I was in the ear of Pete, just build him up. And that's what we did. And then he eventually surrendered. He wanted to talk to his mom. He wanted to use the restroom, and he wanted something to drink. And so he comes in. He collapses into the arms of the officers after dropping his leaving the gun in the car, and says, "Sorry, guys, I wasn't going to hurt you. I was just going to hurt myself." And then they got him in the bathroom. They got him his call with his mom because his mom was in the hospital at the time. And then we're like, "Where's the drink coming from? Why is it taking so long to get a drink?" We hear some SWAT cop in the kitchen rummaging around like E.T., as Mike Albanese describes it, in the fridge. What could take so long? This guy's got a fully stocked fridge. Well, what it was some SWAT cop with a sense of humor was looking for orange juice so that they could get the juice. And that's the truth. That's what happened. He walks up, "Mr. Simpson, here's some orange juice for you."
Oh, my God. Always
yeah,
with a sense of
it.
Humor, huh?
Oh, yeah, always. Gallows humor is how many people survive these careers.
Oh, my God. Amazing. This is an incredible book, and it's been an incredible interview. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Chris Mohandy. This is a Post Hill Press publication. This is the publisher of this book. I know that people might recognize you, or at least they've seen you on ID's Most Evil and the 2018 series Breaking Homicide. For people that might just want to contact you, is there a way they might contact you or see other work? Do you have an Amazon page? Tell us about any of that.
I'm on Twitter. Twitter is Dr. Chris Mohandy, and I'm responsive. If you have any questions about the book, hit me up on Twitter. I respond all the time. Follow me. Direct message me. I'll always acknowledge when a person follows me, and I'll answer the questions. I love taking questions. I'll be doing Dr. Oz this Tuesday. I'll be on that show. I'm still doing appearances here and there, but Twitter is the best way to reach out to me, and I'm very responsive to it.
Thank you very much. It's a fascinating book, Evil Thoughts, Wicked Deeds. Thank you very much, Dr. Chris Mohandy. It's been fascinating. You have a great evening.
Dan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we off air?
Well, we're live, so.
Okay. Well, thanks again. You asked great questions, and it was an honor to, I'm grateful for the chance to talk with you. And thank you so much for reading it. I think it's a great book. I think it stayed true to form. Brian Skoloff, who was my co-author, he kept me on track. He's a wonderful writer, but everybody that's read it says, I feel like I'm in the room with you, Chris, because people that have heard me lecture before say, it's definitely you, your voice, but Brian kept me moving.
Absolutely. It's a brilliant book, and thank you very much for coming on talking about Evil Thoughts, Wicked Deeds. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Dan, take care.
Good night.